Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 17th, 2005. This session is a conversation with Soul Purpose, presented by John Stephen Paul. In the fireside room.
I want to say a little bit about Soul Purpose and the genesis of Soul Purpose this morning. I'd like to talk about our approach to creating plays, and indeed our objectives in this organization. And then we have one more short play to show you this morning, which we'll do sort of halfway through, and then we can perhaps find some things to talk about. Growing up in Fort Wayne, Indiana, I went to Lutheran High School, and there I was recruited by a professor at Concordia Senior College named Paul Harms to be in a play that he was directing. He had some actors at the college, and he needed some more. So he came to my high school, and I was in theater in high school, and asked if there were any actors, and I volunteered to do that. And the play that we were doing at that time was called Christ in the Concrete City, which is kind of a semi-famous play in this particular genre of plays that can be used to preach with. In fact, can be done in the context of a church service. And I was extremely impressed with this play, with the power of this play. It was the story of the passion set in an urban situation. And it moved between the passion story, the biblical context, and the contemporary context in such an interesting way. It just caught my imagination. And I did a few more of those short plays with Paul Harms. Then I went to Valparaiso University, and as an undergraduate, I directed Christ in the Concrete City myself. I think that was about the only play that I did at that time. Went to Coventry Cathedral in Coventry, England, for a junior year abroad, and there became, with 10 other students, part of the cathedral staff, where we created plays for the cathedral congregation and did them all over in different places in this vast cathedral. If any of you have been to Coventry, you know what a huge place it is, and it has all these little chapels. And so we were creating plays for particular spaces with different stories, and my teacher there was Van Cusserow, who was a professor at Valparaiso University. Then I taught high school for a little bit, and then went to graduate school at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, and went to the Lutheran campus chapel there, Calvary Chapel. And I think, like a lot of campus centers, they were glad to have anybody contribute out of their own gifts. And so some friends and I, George and Janet Weller are their names, got together and just started doing plays and musical plays, some that were written, some that we wrote. So we did our work there. Of course, that work at the campus church had absolutely nothing to do with my graduate work. There was a total divide. I never felt comfortable in talking about my work at the campus center in my department of theater at the University of Wisconsin, and we didn't talk too much about our departmental work at the chapel either. So this divide had formed at that point in my life. So through some strange circumstances, a job opened up at Valparaiso University, which I was only supposed to be for 2 years. Somebody was leaving for 2 years, and I was going to take that replacement in 1979 and 1980. And of course, you know, the rest is history. I did not leave. Mm-hmm. About 7 years into my stay there, 6 or 7 years, I thought it just seemed to make sense that students at Valpo, which is a church-related institution, a Lutheran institution, should have some way had the opportunity to make a connection between the theater that they love and their Christian commitments. And it was thinking about that, I was not the chair of the department at that point. I was a regular faculty member. We had a very full production schedule. There really wasn't much time to do this kind of work in the student schedules or in the department schedules. So I tried to pick a time when no one else would want to schedule a rehearsal for any other production. And it turned out that if we started at 8:45 on Saturday mornings, we were pretty likely not to have another rehearsal scheduled at that time. And that was 17 years ago. And we have been rehearsing in Sole Purpose for about that long, about 17 years, on Saturday mornings. We begin at 8:45 a.m. with breakfast. And at 8:45 we have devotions. At 9 o'clock we have breakfast together, and then at 9:15 we do 2 hours and 15 minutes of rehearsal. Over the course of those 17 years, I've thought a lot about the sort of underlying philosophy and even theology of the way we go about our process, our work. But that's basically how we started. And the first couple of plays we did were adaptations of sermons that were preached by our campus pastor. We did one of those here. And so we, from a pretty early point, wanted to do original stuff. Because I was not, let me just say it kindly, I was not acquainted with the genre of chancel drama. Of good chancel drama. I knew P.W. Turner, Christ in the Concrete City, but I'd done that, and it seemed to me that what we needed was more plays that would work this way, rather than to redo other plays. So, also from the beginning, Sole Purpose has been creating original plays. And some of those plays are for specific occasions. We leave them and move on. Some of those plays stay in our more or less permanent, if that's possible, talk about the theater repertoire. And I have some paper here to show you, if you'd like, what plays we do carry with us. So this is a teaching session, and I'd like to just teach a little bit here, not to get too pedantic. But I would like to sort of distill Sole Purpose's objectives into these four phrases, and we have other longer objective statements. But increasingly, it seems to me that our process begins by reading the Bible. Reading the Bible. And when we're working on a new play, we read it. We read those texts again and again and again. We have different people read them out loud. And we will practice this, what's called close reading. Although that is difficult. Close reading is difficult sometimes, given all the different translations that we have to work with. We do read closely, at least. And sometimes we will have colleagues of mine, other professors, come in and talk to us about the text and introduce us to some collateral reading. Fred, for example, has come in to talk to our group before and actually spoke with us about Rachel once as we were preparing a play on the Beatitudes. Dorothy Bass, whose name you know, I hope, was the one who talked to me about the Zacchaeus story that we did last night and suggested that I read Zacchaeus as a hospitality play. And it opened up a wonderful way of thinking about that text, which for me had always been about who you like and who you don't, and why. And Jesus always likes people you don't, you know. But think of it as hospitality, and then that Jesus would be hospitable from the cross, and that the arms are stretched out in a gathering in there was just a wonderful insight. So we have resources at the university that we can make use of, both collateral reading and collegial consultation. So reading, and in days when fewer and fewer people read the Bible, I think this is a worthy objective. Then we move to the creation of a particular theater piece, and in the last 10 years or so, we've been working primarily with the lectionary. Those three or four readings that are designated for Sundays throughout the church year, we do the great majority of our performances in church, and we do many Lutheran churches, mostly Lutheran churches, as a matter of fact, and probably even the Catholic churches and the other Christian denominations that we play to are churches that use the lectionary. So we like this idea of making a connection, a strong connection, between the play that we have made and the lectionary text that the congregation is hearing on that particular day. So that's where we get our basic story. When we know we're going to be performing at a particular church on a particular day, we will go back and look at the lectionary for that day and begin there. That's our invention process. We then, of course, perform. That's an objective of ours, to perform. And here is a personal goal of mine. I would like to find a way to make the theater art as valuable, instructive, beautiful as the musical and the visual arts in the church. That's a highfalutin goal, you know, to actually think you're going to create liturgical art. But that is what I would like to do, and that reflects my background as a theater artist. So the performance, while it may be seen to have sort of moral implications, moral instruction, it may have an exegetical dimension, it has a proclamatory dimension, but I also always try to see if we can make it have an aesthetic dimension. And thus we have quite high standards as we prepare a work of art. The worst thing you can say to me about one of the sole purpose plays is that I liked your skit. Your skit was good. Because for me, that takes a real stab at our pretense toward liturgical art. And then finally, it's to demonstrate that this could be done in someone else's church. That this is a kind of salutary thing for a number of reasons. Not the least of which is that theater artists want to be able to contribute to worship as well. They want to be able to give from their gifts as well, in the same way that people who sing in choirs give from their gifts, in the same way that people who make banners give from their gifts. Well, theater people want to do that too. And in my experience, theater people and church people have not gotten along very well together over the centuries. And that's an interesting story that begins with Tertullian. And maybe even before that. But so another goal of mine is to find a way to bring church people and theater people together. And since we sometimes mention books in these sessions, I'll recommend a book to you that I think is going to lay the foundation for this work very well. It's called Theater and Incarnation, and it's by a man named Max Harris. It was originally published in 1990, and it went on a print. And I got a copy of it and thought it was just a great book. And I think I'm kind of responsible partly for getting it back into print. It's going to be reprinted by Erdmann's beginning this year. So Theater and Incarnation, Max Harris, I think lays the foundation that on which we can build a kind of reconciliation, if that's not too strong a word, between theater people and church people. So read, create, perform, demonstrate. Now I'll go back to this one about creating, and just talk a little bit about this list here. This is Aristotle's list. You've heard of Angie's list. This is Aristotle's list of what makes a play. Now, he was talking about a tragedy when he wrote about in the Poetics, but this is what distinguishes the dramatic genre from other forms of literary art, I guess I might say. And some of these will require less talk than others. The plot, by the plot, Aristotle meant, how are you going to arrange the incidents of the story? How are you going to tell the story? Are you going to start at the beginning and go chronologically to the end? Or are you going to start at the end and then look back to the beginning? Or are you going to mix it up? How are you going to shape that story to keep people interested, to keep people entertained, to keep them in their seats long enough to get to the end? Character. Aristotle thought of character as moral character, but I think it's character along with dialogue that really is the distinguishing, those are the distinguishing parts for plays. And I've had some interesting conversations about this while I've been here, about what it means to write a play as opposed to preaching a sermon and maybe even telling a story. When you write a play, you distribute your thoughts, your message, your point of view, whatever it is, across a number of characters. And if you play fair, you have to give everybody a chance to say what they think and what they want to say. You can call that objectivity if you want to, but if you don't do that, the characters who don't get to talk either have to make it up for themselves or they become props. Right? And I liked Nancy, the other teacher here this week. I loved her distinction. She made a distinction about the difference between an illustration and a character. Now, if you're going to tell a story about a character, at least if you think it's going to be a character, then you have to make it a character with some kind of dimension, with some kind of authentic voice. If you just want it to be an illustration, well, at least be honest about it. You know, it's just a prop. It's like putting up a piece of flannel on a flannel board. So this is what I would say about if I were going to talk to preachers about how to write a play instead of preach a sermon. You gotta let characters have their say. Thought here, we might say, is the idea. What is really the idea of the text, or at least the idea that you as a group of writers or as a writer have found, discovered, and want to lift up? What's the idea? Idea tends to go across some of the genres like essays, for example. But what is it that we want to say here? Melody, remember Aristotle was looking at Greek tragedies, which were divided up between episodes and choral odes, and the choral odes were sung and danced. We know about melody because movies have underscoring all the time. We know musicals and operas, so melody is still a part of it, very much a part of the way we do drama. But the way Sole Purpose tries to do it is to think in terms of some kind of song, spiritual song or hymn, at the end, in which the congregation can join with us to try to kind of heal that breach, that natural breach, which happens when you have a bunch of actors here and audience here. There's a divide, and what we've found is if we can bring a hymn or a song to it, that divide can be healed. Okay, finally then, spectacle. Spectacle, and this is hard for students of mine for some reason, because they tend to think of spectacle as the set, the stage set, you know, what you build. Spectacle is everything you see. Everything you see, including the people who are around you, the stage, the theater, but probably most especially what's in the sight line. when you look. Everything that's there. And Aristotle, here's his true colors. I don't think he really loved the theater because he thought that spectacle was kind of the lowest part here. This is a hierarchical list for Aristotle. And he thought, well, if you really needed to go to see it, okay. But really, all this could be read, and you should get your catharsis by just being able to read it. All right, because of the way the plot is arranged and the way the characters are allowed to speak, you should feel empathy to the point where you are just shaken and your emotions finally just kind of explode and you drain and you're purged. And, you know, you can read, you can get that from reading some of those André Dubus stories, right? I mean, you can have, I think it's possible to have that kind of exhaustion at the end of reading a good short story, and that's where Aristotle was. But still, he allowed us how these plays are done in the theater, and so it's a visual art form. So when we create a play, then we try to keep these parts in mind, and I always hold out for spectacle, meaning that I think that a lot can be said in the theater without saying any words. A lot can be communicated, and often, and we'll see if this works, often what people do remember is not necessarily what our Jesus in Zacchaeus said from the cross, but the fact that Jesus was up there on that cross, and interestingly enough, in kind of the same position that Zacchaeus was not too long before. That's a use of spectacle. That kind of interesting reversal with then Jesus climbs, you know, this is why I climbed up here, so I could see you, and I could see all the people who believe, even though they can't see. So that's how, and you know, most of us still, those of us who are trained on the doctoral level, are still word persons. We're readers, talkers, analyzers. We have to keep reminding ourselves that essentially the theater is a visual art form, and knowing how to manipulate that is the key to success. Okay. Now we're going to do a pretty short play here today called Fools. And it comes from three lectionary texts. We were asked to do this for our chapel last January, and the three texts are Micah 6:1-8. I'm not going to take the time to read them out now. Micah 6:1-8. And the second reading, or the epistle, is 1 Corinthians 1:18, for the message about the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing. And the gospel is Matthew 5:1-12, the Beatitudes. Now, we've been doing this long enough so that it circles back, and we'd already done a play about the Beatitudes. So we thought, well, let's work with that Corinthians text. Let's work with Paul there. And, of course, the word that gets repeated again and again and again is foolishness, the foolishness of God. And so we'll see this play now. It runs about 10 minutes, 11 minutes. And then we'll talk about it and what we do and some of the things that we've done here as well. Okay? You like these ones?
He has told you, O mortal, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you but to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God?
For the message about the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the discernment of the discerning I will thwart. Where is the one who is wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world did not know God through wisdom, God decided through the foolishness of our proclamation to save those who believe.
Where's your sister? She isn't home yet. Or at least, I haven't seen her.
It's getting late. She's later tonight than she usually is. I wish she'd call it a day when it gets dark. I don't like her being out so late. It's not safe. I feel like I'm talking to myself here.
She's a grown woman, Dad. She can take care of herself.
She never learned how to dress herself. Never thinks to wear a heavy coat. It's cold out there. January.
She wears layers. Layers keep you warmer than a coat.
Bought a big coat. A down coat with feathers or fibers or something.
Maybe she's just testing you to see how many times she can get you to tell her to take a coat. The truth is, Dad, when Pauline finds a coat, she gives it away to people on the street.
She comes home so cold. She goes straight to a cup of tea, standing in the wind all day. All I ask is a coat and a hat. It's like she doesn't even hear me.
Oh, she hears you, but that doesn't mean she's going to do what you say.
That seems to be the case with both my children.
When have I ever given you cause to doubt me, Dad?
Let's start with the day you went off to that clown college in Florida. We send you 4 years to the university, and then you say you need to go to clown college. What was I supposed to think of that?
Just think of it as graduate school.
Well, at least it got you a job. You got enough money for work clothes and car fare, and you work inside. Pauline wanders the streets talking to everybody who comes her way. Something could happen to her. There's nuts out there. She doesn't even know the kind of people that are hanging around that square, for instance. They're just waiting to prey on her.
They're not preying with her, Dad. They're persecuting her.
Whatever, smart guy.
It's a part of the job. Just like the suit is a part of mine. Could you really expect her to be anywhere else? It's like the clowns come out of a tiny car in the circus, not Shakespearean actors. It's just the way it is.
Well, if that's the way it is, I don't like it. I mean, I think it's great that she's telling people about Jesus. That's what your mother and I taught her to do. Tell everyone, you know? But it's the way she does it.
You want her to change her style?
She stands there and yells. People yell back at her. She told me that the other day a man actually spit on her. Spit on her! That kind of hatred's dangerous.
She told me that story. Has she told you the other stories? About the people she gets into shelters and clinics? About the ones who love her for listening to them? Or for giving them a buck or two for soup or coffee? Or even on those little green New Testaments she hands out? She keeps on going out there. You must admire her resolve.
Resolve? It's a lot of foolishness if you ask me. I wish she'd think about getting a regular job. If she wants to be a minister, go to a church. Hey, I know. A job just opened up at the factory in the office. She'd be perfect for it. She'd get to know people. She could preach to them there.
You said the same thing to me after I came back from school. An assistant manager position just opened up at the factory. They're going to hire the owner's nephew, but something fell through. I think you would be perfect for the job. You could clown around at company parties.
Well, you would have been perfect. You can't blame me for wanting my kids to have good jobs.
We do.
One a clown and one a Jesus freak.
You wouldn't be equating the two, would you, Dad?
Well, they're both kind of funny jobs, you have to admit. The one's supposed to be funny and the other's, well...
What is it?
Strange. It's a strange thing for my girl to be doing.
It's a strange world.
Why is she doing it, Mike?
She thinks it's what God wants her to do. No, she's sure. This is what God wants her to do.
Then she's lucky.
Lucky?
Lucky to know what God wants her to do. When your mother was alive and you kids were little, it was easy to know what God expected of me. Every day the same. Go to work for 8 hours, come home in time for supper, do a little roughhousing with you two, wash up, sit down, say a prayer, eat, read the paper or watch TV, check your homework, put the two of you to bed. Next day, same thing. On the weekends, it was work on the house, take you to ball games or club meetings, go to church, rest up, and on Monday, do the same thing. When your mother died, everything changed. You went off to Florida. Pauline had a real hard time for a while. But now, I guess you're right. She knows exactly what God wants from her. Maybe that's what bothers me. She knows and I don't. What does God want from me, Mike? Got any idea?
I think God wants you to have these little conversations with me.
For Jews demand signs, and Greeks desire wisdom. But we proclaim Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to Gentiles. But to those who are the called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God. For God's foolishness is wiser than human wisdom, and God's weakness is stronger than human strength.
Matt, you read the new safety memo posted today?
One says be careful not to fall down, skin my knee.
Very funny. Safety's number one around here now, and you've got the wrong shoes.
Yeah.
By tomorrow, or you'll be getting a little more time off than you planned.
Yes, ma'am.
Getting a new temp coming in later. Nice kid.
How come? I thought we weren't getting extra help.
Taking the Indian girl's place.
Debbie?
Whatever, yeah.
Why? She was expecting to go full time.
She was 3 days short of it. Decided we could do better for a full timer. And I think this kid may be just the ticket.
Come on, Jerry. Debbie was good. Hard worker, straight through the shift. No nonsense. On time every day. What do you want?
I want somebody who talks English.
Debbie speaks English.
Not so as I can understand it. She talks Indian English.
It's called an accent. You're half deaf.
What?
Nothing.
Look, it doesn't make sense. It's not safe. I don't have to tell you that we get into life and death situations on the floor here. Trucks and booms and machines all over the place. A person falls down or gets run into. And suddenly they're hurt bad or killed. We need somebody who can tell you to duck in a language you can make out. For all I know, she can't understand us either.
Who's us?
Americans?
Come on, Jerry. Have a heart. The poor kid's had it rough. She's been kicked around. She's got kids of her own, you know, and no husband. She needs this job.
Hey, let it go now. She made good money here. She's smart. She saves some.
Jerry.
She'll find something else. You know how they are. Got big families. They take care of their own. By this time next week, she'll be working at a gas station. You'll see.
This isn't right. You can't just let someone go because you don't like who they are or where they're from.
You're wrong. It's not about who I like. It's about who's best for the floor. Besides, I already did it. She's lucky she worked here as long as she did.
Jerry, what you did was wrong. The girl deserved the full-time job. I won't stand for this.
What are you going to do about it?
What are you going to do about it?
I'm gonna start breaking in the new guy. You?
I'm going upstairs and tell him what I think.
You won't go upstairs.
I will.
You won't. Because about halfway up, you'll start to think about what it will mean to be on my bad side. You'll remember what happened to Pavlik 2 years ago. You'll count how many little favors I've done for you for over 5 years. And you'll decide you like that kind of treatment and come to your senses and hustle back down here and make friends with our new temporary employee. You'll show him the ropes and you'll let him know what's expected around here. I know you, Matt.
Excuse me.
You go up there, and you won't catch another break as long as I'm your super. For since, in the wisdom of God, the world did not know God through wisdom, God decided through the foolishness of our proclamation to save those who believe. For Jews demand signs.
Hey, preacher, show us a sign.
You got all the
but we proclaim Christ free, a stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to Gentiles. But to those who are the called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God.
I'm the fool.
For God's foolishness is wiser than human wisdom, and God's weakness is stronger than human strength.
I played the fool big time today, and now I'm going to pay for it.
God chose what is low and despised in the world, things that are not, to reduce to nothing the things that are.
Don't call me that. Don't call me low and despised. I'm your father. Don't call me names.
Consider your own calling, brothers and sisters. Not many of you were wise by human standards. Not many were powerful. Not many were of noble
birth. Stop it, Pauline! I'm your father, not your brother. I'm a fool. Your brother's a clown. But at least he's got a job.
Dad, what are you doing here?
I hear you help people find the way. Well, it seems I've lost the way. I always thought I knew what I had to do, but now I don't.
Dad.
I don't even have a place to work.
What's happened? What's that paper?
It says I'm fired. Or something nicer. Furloughed.
After 27 years, for what?
Did a foolish thing that I thought was the right thing. I stood up for somebody who was getting screwed at the mill.
You did the right thing.
And she got fired too. So much for seniority, so much for clout, so much for strength through solidarity.
God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. God chose what is low and despised in the world, things that are not, to reduce to nothing the things that are.
Stop preaching at me, Pauline. Stop spraying me with the Bible. I taught you, remember? Your mother and I took you to church, don't forget. You know, it's easy what you're doing. I know it seems hard, standing out here in the wind and the rain without a coat or hat, and screaming out the gospel or whatever until you're hoarse and sick and tired and people make fun of you and spit on you. But I actually did it for once. I did the right thing, the hard thing, and this is where it got me.
So that no one might boast in the presence of God. He is the source of your life in Christ Jesus, who became for us wisdom from God, and righteousness, and sanctification and redemption, in order that, as it is written, let the one who boasts boast in the Lord.
I'm not boasting. I'm just showing you. This is what I've got. This is all I've got. Not much to boast about.
This is all I've got, Dad. Nothing to boast about.
Pauline! See you at home later.
Where's my sister?
She isn't up yet, or at least I haven't seen her. It's getting late.
She's later this morning than she usually is. I wish you'd call it a day when it gets dark. I don't like her being out so late. It's not safe. I feel like I'm talking to myself here.
Are you making fun of me?
Me? Never.
Where were you last night? I got home and you weren't around.
You were late. I went to bed. I hurt myself climbing out of the Volkswagen. Left at the intermission.
What a job.
There you go. That's the kind of talk I'm used to. So, where were you last night?
I had a long day yesterday. I did a fool thing at work, got me laid off.
Oh my gosh. What?
Well, I didn't like the way one of the temporary workers was being treated. My supervisor didn't see it the way I did. So I went up to the management office and had my say.
They hear you?
They listened. They let the temp go anyway. And a few hours later, I got a furlough slip.
You did the right thing, Dad. The just thing.
I guess. It wasn't such a big deal. I know when somebody's getting, what was your word? Persecuted? You must not let stuff like that go on, Micah.
So it's Micah now. You haven't called me that for a while.
I've just been thinking. Your mother named you. You were named after an Old Testament prophet.
I know.
Your mother used to love that verse that said, "Do justice and walk humbly with your God."
What does the Lord require of you?
Do justice and...
love kindness?
Yeah. And walk humbly with your God.
Dad.
What's this?
Put it on. Like this. That suits you.
I don't think so.
He is the source of your life in Christ Jesus, who became for us wisdom from God, and righteousness, and sanctification, and redemption, in order that, as it is written, let the one who boasts, boast in the Lord.
Thank you.
not you. Now, what we thought on the day we did this for worship, that we should hand out with the bread and the wine of Clownos to everybody, but it was a little too expensive for that. And so our campus pastor wore the clown nose as he did the Eucharistic prayer and the distribution. So that was nice. That sort of made the connection for us. Well, we do have about 10, 12 minutes here. Be happy to open this up for conversation, comment, questions about how we work, what we've done here, about this play. I also know that sometimes plays speak for themselves, so don't feel that you have to say anything, but we'd be very pleased to hear what you think.
Does Soul Purpose do any work starting other liturgical drama groups at other universities or institutions?
Well, we will do workshops. I will come out and have a small group of people, and we will work with people, yes. It's better if there is a working group in place rather than us sort of planting something from the beginning. But yes, we do that. We're happy to do that.
I may have missed this at the beginning, but is the scripting a collaborative process?
It is. I
should know this, but...
Well, no, it is, and this was a particularly collaborative one. We began, this was to be performed on January 31st. We began in very late November prior with conversations about this. And I think there were about 12 people had been involved in one at one point or another. Correct me if I'm wrong on this. The workshops are a little bit, it's kind of a moving community. People who are in Soul Purpose, and there are 25 right now, about 25 students in Soul Purpose. They will come into the workshop. Sometimes they won't go back the next week. It becomes kind of my responsibility to be the recording secretary. And email has been very helpful on this, because I will sum up the conversation at the workshop and then send it out to the workshop participants. But this one, you know, I can hear lines, specific lines from people who spoke at the workshop. The one that always makes me think is, she goes right to a cup of tea. That's just not something I would ever say, but that was one of our people who wrote, actually, who came up with the, who wrote the first draft of that first scene, and that line and a couple lines stayed in place. So, it's sometimes a torturous process, but a lot of people's thinking and perspectives and thoughts stayed in on this one. Then later in the year, later in that same semester, Amy led a workshop on the story of the disciples on the road to Emmaus. That resulted in a short play that was performed for one of our morning prayer services. So, to the extent, I mean, the thing about it is that we have a deadline. That's another thing about the theater. The curtain goes up at a certain point. You have to get kind of decisive at some points. And so we try to allow the kind of organic process to go on as long as possible, but then finally it's got to come together. And sometimes that's with more input or less, depending on the group of people who's working on it. It's a really, in some ways, a form of shared preaching. It keeps people involved in the preaching process through to the event. That's one way to think about it.
Question to the students: how did you find out about Soul Purpose? First, get involved. Soul Purpose. What was the draw for you?
Professor Needham. is actually the one who told me all about it when I was a prospective student. And he was a representative for theology, and I was telling him my interests. And he was like, oh, then you should hear about Soul Purpose. And he sent me clippings, and as soon as I get to campus, I tried out, and I was very excited to hear that I was a member. So it is thanks to you.
One of our main buildings on campus is where the theater kind of has its residence, all the classes happen, and you know, along with the music classes and the arts, we have our arts building, and that's kind of just in the middle of everything, so you walk in through all the time. And I'm a science student, so I was, you know, interested in the theater things, but it was, you know, posted up, saw GSP flyers, and so for ones, you know, that are, like, one of the great things I think about our group is we come from all different, you know, fields of study, and, you know, you don't have to be a theater major to be in it, it just has to be, you know, a love of yours, and so, you know, he holds auditions, and I saw it on a flyer.
That would be good, just to do a quick round of introductions about, you know, your name and your major and where you're from. Can I do that, Chad?
I'm sorry. Well, I'm Chad McKenna. I'm going to be a senior next year. Sorry, a little sick. I'm originally from a little town called Lycos, Illinois, near the Quad Cities. And I guess I'm going to talk about how I heard about Soul Purpose. I was kind of I locked myself in my room pretty much first semester freshman year, so I didn't audition at all. But I would always go to morning services, and I saw Soul Purpose. So I had a couple friends for it, and it was really cool. So at the end of the semester, or at the end of the freshman year, I immediately changed my major. I was a comm major. Immediately changed it to theater and joined Soul Purpose. So watching Soul Purpose was maybe the theater major. So
my name is Jamie Petito, and I will be a sophomore. And my major right now is radio and TV. And I heard Soul Purpose because, I've seen them in Sunday morning services. I think Fools and then Annie.
Annie's great.
And those were the two, which were great. And I really wanted to get into the theater aspect at Balfo. And so I asked Professor Paul what I could do, and he suggested this. And that's the history.
My name is Jeff Biebighauser. I'm a recent graduate with a degree in the classics. I'm a late comer to the group. I joined my senior year after seeing them in chapel services and stuff for 3 years.
My name is Rachel Easton. I also just graduated with a degree in science, and I plan to go to veterinary school next year. It has nothing to do with theater, but I've been a four-year member of this group, and I've loved every minute of it. It's been very, very formative in my spiritual experience, I would say, and my growth over the last 4 years. I'd have to attribute a lot of what I've learned to this group.
And I'm Amy Jeffers, and I'm going to be a senior next year, and I'm a theology youth family ministry major with a minor in theater and a bunch of things. And you know what reason.
My name is Deborah Hartner, and I'm from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. I will be a senior next year, and I'm a theology major. And I had first heard about Soul Purpose from my admissions counselor when I was applying to Valpo. And, you know, he kind of told me about it, and I thought, well, that sounds nice, but I want to be in the big plays with the lights and, you know, the real plays. And then I came to Valpo and saw Soul Purpose and what they did. And I didn't know Amy that well at all, but I remember seeing her in the play and asking her, you know, how do I audition for this and how do I get into this group? She told me all about it and what it was like, and the rest is history. So.
My name is Ellie Getch, and I'm from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And I just graduated with majors in biology and chemistry. So Soul Purpose was really just a chance to have fun. I've been in it for 2 years. I think it took me the first two to get up the nerve to audition. But I'm glad I did, and it has been a great experience.
My name is Dan Cobbler. I'm from Valparaiso, Indiana, and I just graduated with a degree in trauma and humanities. When I was a senior in high school, the Schwein twins, John and Martha, you know, Dorothy Bass, program coordinator, her children were freshmen as I was a senior in high school, and they dragged me from my Sunday morning service one Sunday. After service, they said, "You have to drive us over to the chapel right now. Soul Purpose is performing." And I said, "What's Soul Purpose?" And they said, "Just come and see." And so in classic gospel style, I came and saw. And that was the beginning of my experience with Soul Purpose.
Hi, I'm Jordan Chaddock. I just finished my sophomore year, so I will be a junior. And I am a theater and English double major. I got involved in Soul Purpose, sort of a combination of things. I had some friends in the group, a couple conversations I'd had with Dr. Paul, and then a very stunning recommendation from Rachel. So that's why I joined.
And I could tell you a little bit about each one of these actors here and how they play particular roles in the group, and I'm sure they'd be interested to hear how I feel about their place, you know. But the main thing I'd like to say is they're really cool people. And that's what keeps the group going is, you know, when cool people do this, they attract other cool people to them. And one of the best comments that I can get from you know, from people where we've been to church, and somebody will come up and actually have the nerve to say is, "How do you get these really cool people to do this?" And you know, cool is one of those words that you can hear in different ways. And part of the problem, I think, a lot of us, even those of us who are actors, do have our cool sides, you know. And how do you, when I say cool, I mean the opposite of emotionally hot. How do you find a way to be expressive about something that is either so deep or so, it has been so irrelevant in some ways to some people? So how do you move from cool to hot and still stay cool? And that's a mystery of Soul Purpose, I think. So it's 11:45. I'd be happy to stay around and talk, but I think we are supposed to come to an end after an hour. Thank you very much for coming, and thank you for welcoming us to Holden Village. It's been great.